So I want to thank Metagenix for allowing me to be here. I think what SPMs represent in terms of really a breakthrough in inflammatory chemistry is a totally new way of understanding how we're looking at our patients. And it represents, for me in particular, an additional tool for what really amounted to be very difficult patients that I was treating in my practice. And I think for those of us who've been operating in this space for a long time and taking care of patients, you realize in the early days it's a little fun because oftentimes the type of patients that you see are, you know, they might need a little help with weight loss or fatigue or sleep-related issues, and you get the carbs out of the diet and you give them adaptogens and so on and so forth. But your patient population often gets sicker and sicker and sicker the longer you practice. And you end up having to be truly first a problem solver. And that certainly has been my experience in my practice, and I'm sure many of you can, you know, relate to that as well. And when your patients aren't getting better with sort of the standard approaches, you have to really go back to the drawing board. And that's certainly what we did in our practice in terms of collecting data and making, I think, a contribution in a sense to a particular area of inflammatory related problems. And it was interesting that as I started looking at what SPMs do and the role of resolvins, there was a real nice synergy with respect to the challenges medically that we were encountering and what SPMs offer. So we began to run some clinical studies in this regard. And in my practice, certainly like many of yours, I'm certain you see a variety of kinds of inflammatory conditions, including just general chronic inflammation, as well as neuroinflammatory responses, which are what I focus on, all of the inflammation related to obesity and metabolic syndrome, as well as you know, a variety of other conditions. So many of them probably seem obvious to you in a sense, but it's the first one, this sort of chronic inflammatory response that we were stuck in. And that is to say, why wasn't the body turning off its inflammatory cascade? And what we realized is that even when patients were chronically ill, so they had the label of fibromyalgia or persistent fatigue or headaches or joint pain, and yet when we would do our markers, we wouldn't see elevations in your standard inflammatory labs. And the question is why? What's really going on in these patients that were decompensating and becoming sicker and sicker, but we couldn't capture the immune response that we knew was there? And that led us to greater insights with respect to peering into a different part of the immune system. And it turns out there's two sides. There's the adaptive side, which we spend a lot of time evaluating, which is really responsible for mistakes related to autoimmune diseases and even cancer. But then there's the innate side of the immune system, which we've known about for a while, but we really didn't have good inflammatory markers to measure what was going on in this particular area of the inflammatory cascade. And it turns out that this is exactly what was occurring in this patient population that was clearly very ill with a variety of symptoms and problems, but our standard labs weren't capturing it. And so we started looking at transcriptomic markers and proteomic markers like TGF-beta-1 and C3A and C4A and vasoactive intestinal peptide and melanocyte-stimulating hormone and a variety of genomic markers. And I'm sure for some of you, this might be sort of a new language to say, well, I don't even know what he's talking about. And for others, you might draw some of them in your labs. But it turns out this is where the magic was for a lot of these patients that were chronically inflamed. And even more importantly, there's a portion of the population, genetically speaking, that once their innate immune system is triggered, they can't transition to the adaptive side. They don't automatically convert over into the ability to make antibodies. So in fact, what happens is they stay chronically inflamed on the innate immune system side, and they can't resolve their inflammation. And that was the key for us, to say we didn't understand why these patients were always so sick, and we couldn't turn it off. So this ended up being a genetically mediated condition. Now, this is 20% of the population. This is patients that you see in your practice every day. So it's those patients that have fatigue and headaches and joint pain and weight gain and gut dysfunction and skin-related changes and cognitive problems and mood disorders, and they all aggregate those symptoms around this sort of illness complex, but many of your labs will be coming back normal, and they often don't respond to some of the more functional interventions, such as fixing leaky gut and even balancing hormones and repleting nutrients, and they might get a little better, but then they go back to a baseline. And it turns out that if you can't turn off this inflammation, it becomes nearly impossible to get this patient population better. So we began stumbling on this new sort of new entity. And so it was a new language for us as well. We're drawing markers that we wouldn't normally draw. C3A, C4A, which are the alternate complement cascade, TGF-beta-1, which is a transcription factor related to T cell production and Th17 balance, Treg cells, which regulate the immune system, MMP9, which is an inflammatory marker that also will elevate in the setting of this inflammation. We also saw as a consequence that as the body remains inflamed, there are changes in the hormonal cascade. So we saw alterations in ADH, cortisol, and melanocyte-stimulating hormone, which is a master regulatory control hormone produced in the brain, which, among other properties we didn't realize, actually controls tight junctions in the gut. So it turns out that as MSH becomes more and more impaired, the gut becomes leakier. We didn't know that. We also saw poor capillary perfusion, that blood vessels become more constricted as a result. So these patients are also relatively hypoxic. If you look at recent data on chronic fatigue with measurement of cardiac output, this is what's happening. Hypoxia inducible factor, a lowered VEGF, a high C4A, a high TGF-beta-1, constricting blood vessels to the lungs and the peripheral tissue. Patients' VO2 max is dropping, and it's very hard for them to increase it as a result. So they're typically short of breath and inflamed, and at the same time as they accumulate greater and greater hormonal imbalances, leptin levels go up, so they're gaining weight. So these patients are obviously very sick in many different ways, and unless you know specifically how to measure all of this, it's hard to capture. You can see based on symptoms, and oftentimes in terms of your interventions, you might not make a lot of progress until you begin unraveling this cascade of innate immune dysfunction. I'd never explored this area of medicine before. As a conventional physician, I learned all about autoimmune diseases. I learned about standard chronic inflammation. I learned about allergies. I knew nothing about innate immune problems. And what's really key is that with this genetic contribution, these patients, once they're triggered by an exposure, they remain sick for years and years and years. And even if you remove the exposure from their environment, their genes stay on. They're like light switches. So they can't turn off their inflammation on their own. So this is the key in this patient population. So this is what we were struggling with. And as we started talking about the role of resolvins and protectins, the sort of contribution of SPMs, my light bulbs went on. It was, this is a key for us. That if the main problem in this patient population where they can't turn off their inflammatory cascade is that they don't have the ability to resolve that inflammation, now we have a tool to do that, which we didn't before. We had other strategies to sort of manage the inflammation, but this became something really important. And even I didn't realize as we went to the literature how many research studies had focused on resolvins, protectins, myrcins, in their ability to bind to G-coupled protein receptors on macrophages and microglial cells to change their phenotype to turn off or resolve inflammation. I had always thought about Boswellia and curcumin and normal anti-inflammatories blocking that inflammatory cascade upstream, but I didn't realize, and many researchers didn't realize, that you actually have a mechanism to turn off inflammation downstream. This is totally new, completely novel as a mechanism of inflammatory chemistry. And yet there was a whole repository of data that had been growing since the early 2000s. And it became an incredible solution for this patient population. So in partnership with Metagenics, we began to participate in a clinical study And that study was looking at the role of SPMs, and in my case, in my clinic, in our patient population. And so this was a dose-finding study, which we looked at starting with 6 SPMs daily and tracking those patients for a month. The inclusion criteria were basically based on both symptoms in terms of fatigue and pain, as well as inflammatory markers. And then at the 4-week point, we increased to 8 SPMs daily. And we again tracked their symptoms and markers to see whether or not they had an additional improvement. And we had some nice results and even some surprising results, which I'll talk about. But there's clearly sort of this loading phase that you do with patients to send a stronger signal to those macrophages and microglial cells to turn off inflammation. And so here's a smattering of cases that we saw in our practice. So this is a patient, and I don't have a screen here, so I'm gonna step over here. This is a typical patient of mine. This probably sounds pretty common for patients such as yours too. So this is a presenting individual, 54-year-old Caucasian female. She was a computer exec, constant hunger, unresponsive to phentermine, high leptin levels. ADD, neuroinflammation, innate immune activation in the brain. Daily nerve pain with degenerative joint disease. Again, chronic inflammation and arthritis to hips, feet, hands, and back for 12 years. Migraines, pre and postmenopausal, swelling around the brain, swelling of the nerves of the skull, as well as poor blood flow in the venous system leaving the brain. Irritable bowel with constipation. So as much as we see this inflammatory process occurring, the main part of the body that becomes injured as a result of this inflammation, and we're just learning more about it, it turns out, is the nervous system. So nerves become inflamed as a result of this process. And so we see changes not only in the brain, but also in other nerve beds. So our second brain, which is our gut, as well as the electrical system around the heart, and also the nerves of the blood vessel, so the autonomic nervous system. So patients will often complain of irritable bowel, or will diagnose gastroparesis, or gallbladder dyskinesia, or chronic constipation and motility disorders. Varicosities are not uncommon, as well as a DVT, so we see increased production of anticardiolipin antibodies, D-dimer, von Willebrand's factor in this patient population as well. And so we thought she was a good candidate, but her vitals were normal and she had a moderate level of symptoms. When we did her baseline labs at this time, her labs were pending and she'd already been diagnosed with candida. She was thinking, when she presented to our practice, she thought all of her problems, of course, were from a low thyroid, because you could imagine in a patient like this, maybe thyroid is contributing, which it wasn't. Sleep apnea, she had not had a known tick bite and arthritis. So my clinic is in Northern Virginia, which is Lyme country. And so that was the model or door through which we entered. And that is to say, we were having more and more patients that were presenting like this with known Lyme disease or post-Lyme syndrome, but they kept having symptoms and we didn't understand why. And what we were able to do is through looking in the innate immune system paired with genomic markers, it turned out that Lyme disease as a model is a problem with innate immune activation. That what happens is Lyme triggers these genetic sequences, these patients become chronically inflamed, and even when you eliminate the infection, you don't turn off the inflammation. And the consequence of the cascade of metabolic events that occurs after with hormonal problems and gut-related issues and cardiac events and blood clotting and so on and so forth is the consequence of this state of chronic inflammation. So we were desperate to find something to turn off that inflammatory response. Another patient has a history of Lyme with antibiotic treatment. This is very common. We did find markers for reactivated Epstein-Barr as well as positive IgM levels for HHV6. Has a history of atrial and ventricular insufficiency, Holter negative, tilt table test was pending. A lot of these patients have postural hypotension, neurally mediated hypotension, right-sided heart problems, recurrent lightheadedness and presyncope with postural changes, orthostatic intolerance. Again, it's autonomic dysfunction in nerves that are being injured from this inflammation, so the blood vessels don't squeeze, the gut doesn't squeeze, and the brain is inflamed. And she was presenting with anxiety and depression, which is very common, because it's nerves on fire, and in particular, it's a brain that's on fire. So again, we really were looking for ways of measuring whether or not these patients had markers that were reliable that would map onto a constellation of symptoms that sometimes look very confusing. And sure enough, within her innate immune set, her C3a was elevated. C3a is related to bacterial infections. It doesn't always go up, but when it does, it's relatively specific. Her C4a, which was a bit more general as an inflammatory marker, was normal. Her TGF-beta1, again, a transcription factor, was 8,000. That's elevated, and she has a low or undetectable vascular endothelial growth factor, so we know her capillaries are constricted. And so we can better understand why she's feeling the way she is, because Lyme turned on this inflammatory cascade, but she hasn't been given any therapy to turn it off. And in this particular patient, we also did a newer Lyme test called a nanotrap test, which actually captures proteins in the urine that are shed from Borrelia, and it's above 90% specific. It was developed at George Mason University. We know she was not actively infected from Lyme, but she had the consequences of chronic inflammation. So we had to go about the business of turning all of that off, or she was going to remain sick. So what are some of the markers that we looked at in the study? The core set, CRP, IL-6, TNF-alpha, PEGE2, ferritin, sed rate, fibrinogen, all the normals that you would expect, as well as our innate immune set. So C4a and C3a, TGF-beta1, as well as Treg cells, which are CD4, CD25, VEGF, anticardiolipin antibodies, D-dimer, and then we had a variety of validated scales, a general medical questionnaire scale, and then specific questionnaires for a variety of conditions, so pain, quality of life, such as SF-36, GI quality of life. And what we found in our study, as well as what's sort of generally in the literature, is yes, when you look at how SPMs particularly work in the brain, they're at least 10 times as potent as even morphine in how they modulate pain receptors. So our patients almost immediately experienced pain relief to one degree or another when we did the loading doses of 6 or even 8 SPMs daily. But there was more to the story. And we continued to do work because we understood that even when you lower levels of inflammation in the patient, some patients didn't get better. And we didn't understand why. So we could measure resolution. We were using things like SPM. All of their metabolic labs were returning to normal. But something else was missing in the way that we understood these patients, because they still had brain fog and fatigue and pain, and it didn't make sense. But we followed the trail of this kind of inflammation that, when it's triggered, we went with that notion of, we know it damages nerves. It literally injures nerve tissue. And we can see that breakdown under electron microscopy, but we also can see that with a very specific cell membrane analysis. But maybe even more importantly, if you go to sort of the main nerve center of the body in the brain, that's where the mother lode was for us. So we know that microglial cells are the immune cells of the brain. They function just like macrophages. And it turns out that once microglial cells are activated, they release cytokines and other local proteins that will damage dendrites. And when those dendrites start dying, they release markers that further activate local microglial cells. And so there's a cascade, this sort of neuroinflammatory process that's continually injuring centers in the brain. And we knew that we needed a way of measuring the consequence of all of that injury. So we started conducting brain scans in patients using something called a NeuroQuant, which is a very reliable software program tied to MRI. It was originally developed for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's to measure the volume in key areas of the brain, originally the substantia nigra and the basal ganglia. But we applied the methodology of NeuroQuant, a volumetric brain scan, to this patient population. And it was very reliable, but also surprising in what we saw. We didn't expect to see the amount of damage to the brain that occurs in this patient population. So one of the breakthroughs that we feel that we've made is understanding this sort of relationship between a vulnerable population, genetically speaking, who's triggered their innate immune activation that can't turn it off even when you remove the trigger, whether it's Lyme or mold or Fusarium or ciguatera or algae or other things, and that if left unchecked, this inflammation grinds away at the brain and it keeps damaging it. And we see ultimately first functional alterations in how the brain performs, but finally and concerningly, structural changes. And so this is a brain injury pattern that's occurring in your patients. So when you have these individuals that present with this constellation of symptoms, not only is it your job to identify when the innate immune system has been triggered, but also to help them resolve inflammation, but also repair the brain. And so this is a model. So here's an example of a neuroquant. We do various slices, coronal and sagittal. And what we're looking for are volumes of key areas. And what we've been able to identify is that not only are there changes related to these exposures, but surprisingly, even though when you have a patient that's been bit by a tick and they have chronic inflammatory response, the consequence damage to the brain is unique to the exposure. So for example, we can now tell the difference between someone who's been living in a moldy environment, someone who's had Lyme disease, someone who has PTSD, someone who has had a traumatic brain injury, MS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, so on and so forth, just by the injury pattern on neuroquant. So we've published a number of studies now looking at these volumetric changes, and we know that you need a software program to do this. Radiologists are not very good at eyeballing MRIs when you're trying to measure in very unique detail key areas of the brain. And so what we found is that in patients that have been living in a water-damaged building, they'll have increases in their forebrain parenchyma and their cortical gray matter. We'll see changes in their hippocampus. We'll see shrinkage in their caudate, as well as changes in their cerebellum and thalamus. It's this ranking system that we've been able to identify that's the end consequence of neuroinflammation, that the brain is becoming injured in very specific ways. But what's interesting is that it's different for Lyme, that the brain injury pattern for some reason is unique to the exposure. Even though the genetic sequences are similar, the inflammatory response is the same, the consequent damage is different. So now we're doing genomic studies trying to better identify what are some additional markers that we're missing to try and explain the differences in the end damage in these patients. So this becomes part of the identification of original cause, but also part of the clinical solution. And that is to say, you have to identify the exposure, you have to turn off inflammation, and you also have to repair the damage to the nervous system, and in particular, the brain. And part of that solution is improving blood flow to the brain at the very end of therapy, and we do that through multiple ways. We use special herbal extracts and other neuropeptides, but the key is making sure that you have dealt with the engine of the problem, which is the chronic inflammation. And again, we didn't have a great tool for that, especially until we started learning about resolvins and protectins, because that's exactly what they do. So it turned out these patients were even more complicated than we realized. It wasn't just about getting them out of the moldy environment or killing the ticks or making sure that they didn't swim in algae, that all these consequent changes were occurring, and we had to have a very specific discipline of dealing with how sick they were. So this has formed the basis of our work, and a lot of it was stimulated by this notion that we know resolvins and protectins bind to receptors and microglial cells in the brain and turn off that central inflammatory cascade. There was a whole body of literature that I had to become familiar with and become confident in, and there are very few things that actually stimulated resolvin production. And in fact, just the opposite, the sicker your patients, the lower their levels of endogenous resolvin. So you have to do something to raise their resolvin pools to begin to stimulate the immune system's ability to go back to normal. This is so hugely important in this patient population. In fact, it's the whole game. It's the whole game. Otherwise, they'll remain sick, and they'll continue to damage their brain. And one of the problems with that is we now know through sort of new thinking around neuroinflammation, there's basically two ways the brain can deal with inflammation. The first is just like when you cut your hand, tissue can scarify and it basically dies. And the brain can do that. So basically it will atrophy. And we know when you see areas of the brain that are shrunk in a neuroquant, those areas might be permanently damaged. But it turns out that there's another way that the brain handles this, and it's called dendritic pruning, that those areas are shrunken and the dendrites have withdrawn within themselves. But if you stop inflammation and nurture those dendrites, you'll see pruning, you'll see regrowth, that in fact volume starts to expand and the brain heals itself. So there's a moment where we can look at these MRIs and say, you know what, this could all be pruning, and if we just turn off your inflammation, we have a chance of healing your brain. And that's exactly what we've seen. We've published studies on this, doing pre and post analysis in this patient population. But we've learned the hard way, the key is you have to turn off inflammation first to be able to heal the brain. That's the key. So how do you begin to segregate patients or identify who might be a candidate? It's pretty simple as an algorithm. When you look at the literature on SPMs, they really work sort of across the inflammatory cascade. So whether it's sort of, you know, general chronic inflammation, if there's a high SED rate or CRP, or if they have the presence of an autoimmune disease, they still modulate IL-6 and TNF-alpha and so on and so forth. But for me personally, and obviously sort of drilling home the point in this very sick population who I didn't seem to have any clinical tools to help, resolving inflammation was a key factor in creating a solution. So even in this very difficult to treat group, we found a solution for SPMs. And the idea then is you load the patient, you can choose 4, 6, or even 8 SPMs daily. I would suggest doing it for at least a month, and then rechecking in with the patient, seeing how their symptoms are. And if they're getting some resolution, then you can back down to 2 tabs daily. Or you might want to consider for another month at a higher dose and then back down. That's usually enough. Up to 8 weeks or so at the higher level before you can go down to 2 tabs daily. So I'm going to stop there.